This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is iFanboy Booksplode, Avengers Forever. Hello, welcome to iFanboy Booksplode, Avengers Forever. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I am here with Josh Flanagan.
Hello.
And this is the show unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy, where Josh and I take a look at a collected edition, a trade paperback, an OGN, something more than a regular comic every other month. And this month, we decided to talk about Avengers Forever because we just haven't had enough of Kang. You know, it's funny, I didn't even think about it when because we've been talking about doing this for a while, this particular volume. But they just recently, time has no meaning, announced they're doing a new Avengers Forever story.
That's good. Now when we talk about it on the show, we won't sound completely lost trying to
remember
22-year-old memories.
So that's coming out at some point soon. I don't know when. But anyway, let's talk about this one. This was a... spoilers. Spoilers for an old comic. This was a 12-issue series that came out while we were still in college. It started our senior year. Started coming out in 1998, ended up in 1999, and at the time was a huge deal. This is written by Kurt Busiek and drawn by Carlos Pacheco with some inkers. And actually, just Jesus Marino the whole time. Look at that. They have the
really?
Creative team
Jesus
together
Marino.
For the whole
no
time.
Kidding. I didn't know that he'd inked prior to... He's been around a long time.
Let's do this Jesus properly, Marino. Like a real team who hasn't skipped the Booksplode since August. Avengers Forever, written by Kurt Busiek, with plot assist by Roger Stern, the great Roger Stern. Art by Carlos Pacheco, inks by Jesus Marino, colors by Steve Olif. Yeah, I mean, basically, the creative team is the same all the way through. Richard Starkings on letters with Albert Duchesne. That's pretty amazing.
I believe that's pronounced Duchesne.
Duchesne?
Duchesne.
It's not as much fun as Duchesne.
Albert Duchesne? No. Well, it's true, but...
At the time this book came out, Kurt Busiek was still writing Avengers with George Perez. So that was the hot book at Marvel. And they announced they were doing this Avengers standalone. It wasn't an event. This gets in the whole what is an event conversation. But it wasn't like an event book, but it was more like they're doing like a prestige Avengers miniseries outside of the Avengers book. And so it was a big deal. And as someone like me, who grew up reading... all comics, but from the Marvel side, the Avengers was one of my favorite characters. I was super excited because Busiek and Perez's Avengers book was like a return to glory after the horrible situation with Rob Liefeld doing Avengers or Captain America, whoever was
doing
Avengers.
So he wrote this at the same time that same he time. Was doing... That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, it's too bad because he really phoned it in on this one.
So,
like he didn't put anything into it.
Yeah, he relied heavily on Jesus Marino. No words in the script.
I mean, and the plotting was so basic.
Yeah, not complicated at all. Can you imagine reading this over a year span?
I did it, Connor. I was there.
I was going to ask you, did you read this at the time? Were you excited? I know you were inching back into comics at this point.
Yeah, I wasn't super... I would say I'd been reading for about a year or so at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like I didn't know comics. I knew all this stuff from before. But I don't know that I knew enough to be excited about the people involved. I know that I've been reading Avengers, and I had just been learning, you know, over that time, like, oh, I like this Busick guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, I was excited, but I didn't have a strong Kang love at that
sure.
point. Although this might have had something to do with it. But I do remember thinking it was really fun, but I also absolutely remember losing track of it.
Yeah.
And going into this time reading it again, I thought, I'm probably just going to lose track of it again. But I think because I mainlined it so much, it wasn't any less complicated than I remembered, but I did hold on a lot better. I had more to work with.
I have the collection, and I've owned the collected edition for a while, but if you're a Marvel Universe subscriber, all the issues are on there, which I think is how Josh read it.
It is, yep.
I remember at the time, especially with the first issue, being like, what the fuck is this?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, again, it's 1998. There's really no internet. I mean, there is, but there's not the way there is now. It's not like you really knew what was coming, other than like maybe you saw a house ad or saw it in comic shop news or something. But it wasn't like you knew a lot about what was coming. And also, we're in college, so I wasn't spending a lot of time keeping track of what was coming comics-wise. I just went to the store every Wednesday. I was too busy doing other things.
The internet was nascent.
Right. So I remember thinking, cool, this Avengers event, Captain America's on the cover, there's Giant Man. I don't know who all the other people are, but we'll figure it out. And then the first issue, I was just like, what is happening? I feel like I've been bait and switched. And I remember it took a while until I really got into it. And by the end, I loved it. I mean, this is one of my all-time favorite Avengers stories. But it was at first like, what is this I'm reading? It's not the Avengers of the time. It's a sort of all-star, out-of-time Avengers team. There's some very unusual team members here. And it wasn't, you know, the Captain America I love to read. It wasn't the Hawkeye, although it was the Hawkeye I love to read. He just didn't look the way
he was. Yeah, it was both of those things at the same time.
Right. So I remember as a 20, 21-year-old, I was like, what is going on here? But by the end of it, I loved it. So Pacheco was a big deal at the time. He made a name for himself on the X-Men books, and so him going over to the Avengers family was a big deal. This was a huge deal and a huge seller, a big success for Marvel. Now, we'll get to the story in a second, but Josh, I thought from a craft standpoint, what was really interesting about this book was that this period of time, the late 90s, is like a transition point in terms of how comics are graded, how they're written. We're just like a year and a half. Bendis is around doing indie books right at this point, but he's not doing Marvel books yet. He hasn't
started Ultimate Spider-Man yet? I feel like that was 2000.
2000, I think. So yeah. By the end of this book, he's just months away. But by the beginning of this book, it's still about a year. So this is still kind of the old school style of comics. You know, Bendis doesn't come in. Warren Ellis's stuff with the Authority doesn't change the style. This is sort of the last vestige of your classic comic book style where you have third-party narration and a lot of words.
I was wondering how intentional that was. I was like, is this how... I don't think that this was how Busick wrote everything at this point. Like, if you were to read his Avengers from the same time period, I feel like this was somewhat deliberate.
I don't know. I think this was the style.
Really?
Because Bendis hasn't started yet. And it really changed with him.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I just don't think of it that way. I think of it as a sea change, and he was, you know, among the forefront of it. But I mean, like, so I don't know. I don't know if I was thinking that it was like retro modern or what, but it feels really overwrought. But in that way, the whole thing tends to straddle a lot of eras, if I might, you know, like it would fit like with the form. Mm-hmm. To have it be sort of written in one style and look in a different style, you know, because the characters are from all over time and they go all over time and it's sort of all the things at once, everything coming at you as big and fast and hard as possible. I think that even if this was the style, I tend to think, and I don't know because I don't have the context for it anymore, but I tend to think that he had turned up the dial on it. Like, he's like, I'm going to full Stan Lee you.
And that's possible, but this certainly wasn't, this wasn't a throwback. This is basically how Avengers was written. Yeah. Maybe not to 11 like this. It really is Bendis and Ellis that changed the whole game in about a year's time from the start of this.
Yep. Yeah.
And so what I found myself thinking is, I really like this style. Now, do I want to read 25 books a week like this? No.
Ooh.
Because I don't have a lot of free time. But I loved reading this book. I miss the captions that are talking to you or are not just gussied up thought balloons.
Sure.
I just like it. It just feels comfortable. But it's a lot, though.
It is. You know, it's interesting, too, is that I found myself curious. I was like, this must be digitally lettered, but early digital lettering, relatively speaking.
Yeah, maybe.
And I don't
think Comicraft. It was Comicraft, so that probably
would be. Okay, digital. Yeah. So that's, and that's sort of one of the real front runners in digital comic book lettering.
Yep.
And then the other bit here is, I believe it's digitally colored, but I can't be sure. Although this might have been like the color separation. I think it's digitally colored, though.
Steve Olaf from oleoptics.com and graphic color, the color separations. So I don't know.
Those color separations is usually a thing. Like, one person does the colors and then somebody else comes in and does them on the computer.
Right.
I feel like. But if you look at, like, there's a bit where there's a Captain America energy shield kind of thing. And like, that's clearly
digital.
Anyway, the point that I'm making is actually that it wasn't overdone in either case.
No, because Marvel will not figure out how to do that for a while.
Exactly. And so I was kind of surprised that I was like, this is probably going to look ugly. But again, it was a thing that really straddled times. It, like, if this came out today, I'd be like, this coloring is perfect.
Yeah.
And it is.
This is exactly how it should look.
So those elements of it are not the things that made it look like it was out of a different time. The coloring was, you know, again, perfectly valid if it was today. Perfect for what it is. The high-test colors, you know, stand out. Your purples for your Kangs. Your yellows for your Pyms. And
yep.
The whole time I kept hearing Gabe Hardman in my head, because Gabe Hardman drew Secret Avengers at one point, and he complained because most of the characters who were males were blonde males who had exactly the same face, and boy, did this book suffer from that. Here, the main characters in this book are Rick Jones, who is the one who has slightly brownish hair. Other than that, you have Clint Barton, Steve Rogers, two Hank Pyms, and a Captain Marvel, who are all white men with blonde hair.
Yeah.
It's pretty rough.
I don't know what that says about the Avengers, but they attract a type.
Well, they were originally called the Aryan Avengers, and they dropped that.
So the premise of the story is, and I would struggle to even.
I got so excited when you said is, I was like, go on.
I would struggle to even sum this up in a paragraph, because it's a Kang story. And as we discussed a couple weeks ago on the Pick of the Week show, in which Kang the Conqueror number 4 was Pick of the Week, it's not a great Kang story unless it's slightly confusing.
I was about to say, you just said it's a Kang story, and I was like, that doesn't even cover it. Like, it's right. Honestly, it's the Kang story. And it's because we are currently reading, if you're listening to this in real time, the Kang the Conqueror miniseries. And I'm not going to say I was surprised, but it was interesting to note that so much of that clearly comes from this. And then this is clearly drawn from basically every time Kang or Immortus showed up. This is your master Kang class.
Yeah.
In this
is your graduate class.
Originally, like I said, when I read it, I was left like, well, I don't really follow all that. But now, because of the way that it was told, like, I felt like I was like, they must have told us everything that ever happened to Kang in here. It was actually fairly well laid out in a way that I didn't grasp it before, that I kind of do now. And you know, the story part of it is just, it's a man pushing against his destiny when he knows his destiny. I mean, that's kind of what it is. And he's going to be who he is, and he doesn't want to be.
And that's always Kang's problem. He doesn't want to be Immortus.
Yeah.
Because that guy's a fucking intellectual.
Well, that's all of us.
Immortus is trying to kill Rick Jones. The only part that really I didn't really know much about, because I wasn't reading the stuff at the time, was the Rick Jones Destiny Force Captain Marvel situation, because that led to a Captain Marvel book where Rick Jones was like, it was almost like a Firestorm situation. I didn't really read that at the time, so I didn't really follow all that. But somehow Rick Jones had the Destiny Force inside of him, which is a callback to the Kree-Skrull War. Again, this is like a Avengers spanning story. It's a time spanning story. So a bunch of cosmic characters, the Supreme Intelligence and Libra, they go through time and pull together a Avengers team to defend Rick Jones from Immortus. And that includes the Captain America, who was disillusioned after discovering the American government was infiltrated in the first Secret Empire storyline, not the Nick Spencer one, but the original one. So he was mopey the whole time.
Like almost too much, but enough that you're like, this is very funny.
Then you had two Hank Pyms. One was the current Hank Pym, who was from the Avengers book. So he was Giant Man. And then you had his crazy alter ego Yellow Jacket, who didn't know he was Hank Pym. I guess never took off his mask.
He didn't know that Giant Man was Hank Pym. So he did for a while. I don't remember the point where he realized he did, because eventually he figured it out. But he did not know that the very large man.
I thought he didn't know he was Hank Pym.
No, he
at one point he's like, I'm Pym.
He knew who he was. He didn't want to go back to who Hank Pym was. It's sort of like the Hulk knows he's Banner, but he doesn't like Banner. That's the way that I looked at it.
Right.
But he didn't know his own future, so he didn't understand that he goes back to being Pym. And when he found that out, he just didn't want to. So his actions are... Here's the thing. I don't think we can explain all this, and I don't think we need to. So I think...
No, I just want to get to the roster.
Right.
Then you have the Wasp, also from the current team. So Wasp and Giant Man are from the Busick and Perez book. Songbird, who was from the future and also from Thunderbolts.
Busick and who drew it? Oh, this is Bagley.
Favorite book of all time.
It's Bagley.
The Captain Marvel from the future, and then the star of the book, really, is one Clinton W. Barton. I don't know what his name, what his middle initials.
Or as he referred to himself several times near the end, Brer Barton, which was quite a stretch.
Brer Barton. That was a few times throughout the book.
Yeah, like it wasn't just once. The first time I was like, that's interesting. And then he said it again, because he would refer to himself... In that he was full on Hawkeye in this, like exactly.
Well, this is with post Kree Skrull War Hawkeye wearing not the purple outfit.
A costume is actually worse than what he has now.
Yeah, no, if you didn't think it was possible, his half top shirt, and I'm trying to find a good.
There's
panel.
A lot of science. There's a lot of science that doesn't make sense in comic book, but the science of how the sort of capelet top that he wears sticks to his skin,
right?
Is Pym part of that problem, I guess so.
So.
He had mutton chops.
If you're rather new to comics, you've heard us talk about Hawkeye now and how he's not the original. He's not the old Hawkeye. And, you know, just how the personality is different. Read this book. This book will lay it out for you. This is how Hawkeye was when we grew up. He was the insecure carny.
Chip on his shoulder.
Who spoke with sort of a... He dropped his G's and...
Yeah.
Very different than the Hawkeye now. And this is the one I grew up reading.
There was a high count of some of my favorite Marvel nicknames, such as Tall Socks and High Pockets.
He always called Giant Man High Pockets?
Tall Socks. Yep. Oh, that came up a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, Brer Clint. Brer Hawkeye.
So then they spend 12 issues either chasing Kang or Immortus, or running from Kang and Immortus, or fighting Kang. There's a lot of things that go on here.
They teamed with Kang.
Teaming up with Kang at the end. They take a trip through... Marvel history. They go to the Old West. They see all the classic Marvel Old West characters.
Then they take a trip through alternate Marvel history, because there's bits where it happened. You go, I don't remember this. And they're like, well, we don't remember this. And you go, oh, this never happened in our timeline. I guess the other thing that sort of came out, just like I said, it reminded me a lot of the Kang series that we've been reading now, is also how much of the recent Loki series, which I forgot Loki was even in it, came from this.
Well, that was the other thing I thought while reading this was, this particular book is almost like a Rosetta Stone for a lot of things going on now, or things we've talked about in the last year. I mean, there's even a whole bit here that references the Avengers West Coast storyline that was a book split earlier this year, when they talk about the Vision's body and whether or not it is actually the Human Torch and where it comes from. And they even go back to a scene from the book that we read earlier this year.
Yeah.
Between that and the Timekeepers... That was directly in the Loki series. There's a lot of stuff we've been dealing with this year was in this book. It was really sort of eye-opening, because I haven't read this book in, I don't know, 20 years.
And in Loki, the Immortus / Kang is never called that. He is an Immortus-type version of that character. He's called He Who Remains.
Right.
But there is a He Who Remains in this who is neither of those people.
Unless he is.
Unless it is.
That's what I assumed he was him. Yeah, in the Loki series, he was called He Who Remains, and he was wearing Immortus's outfit. And here, He Who Remains is a different character who I just always assume the last man standing is Kang somehow.
Right.
It's just this time-spanning, so super Marvel-y adventure, you know, where Rick Jones is constantly complaining about being left behind, which I think is funny, because he doesn't have superpowers, although he does.
Can I point out that the very first issue, the cover of the very first issue is Rick Jones in a wheelchair, and he's got Reebok pumps on. Uh-huh. And he has a Hot Tuna t-shirt on. Now, Hot Tuna is a real rock band from 1969, which is a spinoff of Jefferson Airplane. So
everything about this, though, I loved. I love the title treatment, which is that classic Avengers font for each title of the issue. I mean, this just felt... This feels like sort of one of the ultimate Marvel books.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it was fun.
Well, yeah, let's get into the, like, what surprised you? What did you like as you sort of went through it?
Well, I have the vaguest of memories of the actual mechanics of the plot. So, you know, it was all new to me in a way. But I really liked and was surprised by how much, as you said, it was sort of a Kang masterclass. It's not just these Avengers come together. We spend, I think, like two full issues almost on Kang's history. At least one.
One that is from... He's gone to his thinking place, and it's basically just him narrating his entire history
right. To
himself, and it is vast. And I thought, really, did Kang show up this often? Because in 1999, the Marvel Universe was 37 years old, mm-hmm. 37, 38 years old, 61 is Fantastic Four. And, you know, I thought, God, did he show up this much? But then I thought, you know, I bet most of these things happened in one issue, maybe two.
Right.
Because that's just how it went back then. They had to think of a lot more stories back then. They didn't have to make them as detailed, but, you know, that's how it goes. And, yeah, I was really impressed by sort of the... And he's not even, like, he's not Doom. Like, he's not the number one villain.
But he's an all-time Avengers villain.
And Fantastic Four.
Really laid out here. I mean, you going through some major moments in Marvel history that are alluded to here. There's a lot more here than I was expecting about the Vision, about his identity, which is sort of tangential but becomes important later on. I was surprised by how much Busick and Pacheco enjoyed employing the very, very long and skinny panel on the left-hand side.
That's true. Yep.
There's a lot of like page-long panels. And also just, I was impressed, especially since they did the whole series, of how much is... in these pages.
It's so much.
These are panels, and they're packed full of action and characters and dialogue and captions and everything. There's like, no, you can't pick a page here and open it up and it's like a three panel, you know. Well, there's maybe one or two. I just found one, but they're mostly just
also,
packed full of panels.
If then we're going to put it in the time that it was done, so this would have been 98 or mm-hmm. so. Internet was a thing, but it was not... I don't think necessarily most people had it.
Yeah.
Probably on dial-up at this point. It is not, you know, all-encompassing. So chances are the editors, the folks at Marvel, assistant editors, whoever, interns, had to send packs of reference research because there's, like, literally every Marvel character is in here. I mean, not literally every, but, I mean, hundreds of them and designs, things you couldn't possibly know. The research that this must have required in the fact, like, going back to what were probably, like, the actual comic books.
Oh, my friend, you did not read through the trade. I have the appendix in the trade, which goes through each issue and tells you where the characters came from. Limbo was first seen in Avengers number 2. Immortus debuted in Avengers number 10. Like, it was every, you know... Dr. Doom's fateful meeting with the Pharaoh Ramatut occurred in Fantastic Four Annual Number 2. Like, Busick went deep on this.
And I don't mean to take away from anybody who does this kind of work today, but it is more impressive to have done it then.
Right, because you couldn't just call it off
just
the internet,
is.
Wikipedia.
Right. And, I mean, or even they have files or they can cross-reference or whatever, but, like, he had to know, you know, certain parts of it. And then you go and you've got to read the thing.
And you need the visual reference for the artists.
Yep. And it's just
a lot of work.
Yeah, but so at the same time, you know, I wasn't necessarily enough of a Marvel head at the time to, like, I could appreciate the craft of it, but I didn't get as many of the references and bits this time, you know.
I mean, even though I had been reading for 15 years at that point, I still, a lot of what had gone over my head, much less now than I, you know, as a super user now, I get a lot more of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just this appendix just goes on for pages and pages. I mean, if Busick didn't read the entirety of the Avengers history to do this, I don't, you know, he must just have it at his fingertips.
I mean, I think there's a good chance that a lot of these guys did. I think Busick and Wade, who are coming up at the same time and while are not interchangeable, they're...
Well, you'd be not to be surprised that Wade was involved in the germ of this idea.
Yeah, I can see that. But I sort of put them together in my head because they both discovered them at the same time, this late 90s Marvel thing, and they stood out, you know, as oh, this is, while sort of in the style, there was a freshness about the two of them, and they came in and they did a lot of great comics. I mean, their Gosh scale was very high at the time.
Off the charts.
There was a thing for that. And they just got it, not unlike a Geoff Johns would do, you know, 8 years later or so from that. And they don't have the same style. They're not the same guy.
No.
But I do think of them as sort of like they came through and rushed it at the same time. And, you know, when then Wade not long ago did that History of the Marvel Universe thing, which reads like this, but with less plot. Right. You have to make it up.
It was Wade's idea to pull the Avengers from various points in time.
And that's the thing that makes this a perennial.
Yep.
Because it's the thing that makes it not, like, that's why you don't do it in the regular Avengers ongoing book right there. Even though you could have, because you've got Hank and Janet, you know, they could have been the linchpins and you could have said this was going. It's not all that different from whatever Jason Aaron's been doing in Avengers now. But it's funny to have him do this at the same time as he's doing Avengers, which is at the same time as he's doing Thunderbolts. Those are all big-ass team books.
Yeah.
That's like a lot of energy. I really wonder what his scripts look like. I don't know if they did full script back then.
There was actually a really good introduction he wrote here. It was 2 pages.
I just read the issues, basically.
Sure. But I had the whole thing, so I read this too. And he said basically they almost loosely plotted it. Like they had a roadmap, but they were like, we'll see if we get there.
Wow. I think that shows a little bit.
He usually works with a super, super tight outline, but here he was like, let's just see what happens. We know the big pillars. We know the big beats, but let's see. And they said they pulled it off for the most part. Mm-hmm. I had tons of fun reading this. I mean, it's dense. It took me a long time. It was 12 issues. It's probably enough material for like 30 modern comics, but I had fun. I remember, you know, at the time, just wanting a big old Avengers story. And this was like, okay, now it's an issue with the Kid Colt and the Two-Gun Kid. And now it's an issue with these future fascist Avengers. And now it's an issue about Kang. So I think at the time, not that I was a child, but I was younger. I wasn't really appreciating. And I did enjoy it. I did really enjoy it the whole thing the way through. But I didn't love it as much as I was hoping to because it wasn't what I was expecting. But by the end, I did love it.
I didn't at any point expect not to love it. Mm-hmm. But I loved how hard it leaned into what it was.
Right.
Like, it was so... And no one could do this now. This is the other thing. No one could do this now unless they had grown up reading these comics as they were coming out and had, you know what I mean? Like, even if Dan Slott's got to be younger than these folks.
But yeah, even for like, sure.
I don't think it works. Like, guys who came up reading comics in the late 60s and 70s and then got involved in them professionally, like, they had that. And they lived in a couple of different worlds and there wasn't so much of a line behind it. I think that this book came out exactly when it did, when it had to, and it couldn't have come out at any other time. And for I don't know if you are 10 years younger than us and you go back and read this, I don't know if it's going to do the same thing for you. I still think you can enjoy it. You might not enjoy it exactly the same way, but that's everything.
Yeah, I love this story. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. You have to buckle your seatbelt.
Yeah.
For a wild Kang ride, you know, Kang bang, walla walla bing bang, as Alcott calls him in the page I just found. It's really a Hawkeye tour de force.
It was that. Another bit, I think, was at the end, you think you're going to lose track of it, and that's when they show up with a Kang cycle, which is this three-wheeled, armored cycle that goes through time. Kang is in the front with an armor shield, and then in the back is Rick Jones, and then strapped on. There's two seats in the back. I'm looking for it to see who's in the other seat, but right. And then strapped to the back is the Supreme Intelligence, who's much larger than the whole thing itself. The Supreme Intelligence is one of my favorite villains because you just have no idea what to even do with that. Like, I don't know if he's a good guy, if he's a bad guy. I don't know anything. Oh no, Rick Jones is driving, and then Kang is in the back seat, and he is armed to the teeth. He's got his big double barrel gun in his right hand and his big sort of rocket launchery thing in his left.
Oh, yeah. I found that page.
And then the Supreme Intelligence is just hanging off the back. But you got to understand, he's like a giant SEAL tank.
Yeah.
And there's Kirby dots all around, everywhere. And then it's great. I just have to. So that's at the end of, I think it's the 10th issue, maybe the 11th. I think it's the end of the 10th.
It's the end of 10.
Is that shows up. And then as you come into the 11th issue, the first page is, or the second page is that, them coming back in. And the second panel is basically the same shot from a slightly different angle. The second panel is the Avengers, all of the blonde men reacting.
Mm-hmm.
And just the big giant man is like, Kang? And then Yellowjacket, yep, Kang. Rick? And then Clint delivers the Supreme Intelligence on a dune buggy? Fuck yes. It's joy.
I think 11 was my favorite
comic
issue.
Book form. Yeah, it got better as it kept going. It didn't lose steam.
I loved the Kang Avengers team up. You know, I always loved that.
Yeah, I like that. And there was they also helped illustrate a thread where Kang throughout the whole thing in history really respects the Avengers. Like right. There's all these times where he doesn't kill them or he doesn't.
Well, yeah, Immortus was supposed to destroy them, but he keeps the Timekeepers from killing them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a hell of a book. It is a moment in time that is captured really well and captures the end of an era really well. And I think if you weren't reading that then, you have to know that going into it, that this is not like any comic you're going to be reading this week.
Yeah.
It's a time and a place. And it's not like the 60s comics either. It's a combo. It's a mishmash of the of the eras. It's modern, but it's throwback. It's dense. It's over the top. It's very fun.
So this would be the point where I would ask, is there anything you didn't like about it? But I couldn't think of a way to answer that.
Yeah, it's tough because it's so sprawling, you know. There might be scenes or whatever, but...
The things that are weaknesses about it don't feel that way because that's part of the enjoyment. Weaknesses are really just it's way too much.
Yeah,
it's a lot. If a comic book like this came out now and I don't think I could... Even if it was trying to be retro-modern or God forbid somebody was doing this sincerely now, you'd be like, all right, less on the pages. But in this, it's just so much part of what it is. But I think if you read...
Right.
What was that Green Lantern? The Green Lantern. That felt the a Green little Lantern, this. The Grant Morrison book where it was just so much coming at you all the time and it was just on the edge of being unhinged. Now, I didn't have enough to hold on to there. And it was probably more frenetic, but that's the closest I can think of sort of a modern version, or contemporary, not modern.
Right.
Of sort of that kind of book, and it doesn't work really well. I think.
But even then, you had a art style that's completely opposite of this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But at times, Liam Sharp's art style is completely opposite of itself, so...
Well, that was another problem, yeah. There's nothing like it. They don't make comics like this anymore. They don't make them like they used to, kid.
I guess the other thing is that, you know, it was supposed to feel like it was something special, and it was an event, and it did.
Yes. It has whatever that magic is, that undefinable, that modern events just don't have.
Yeah. It's the every time we read a modern event, we're like, why didn't it feel like that? You know, that's really, what, I'd love you compare this to, Fear itself. What was the difference? Or to the Tree People one that they just did. Who are name-checked in this? The Kotati exist in this.
Right.
Empire. You know... I don't know. I think it was the thing is that Kurt Busiek was actually doing it and other people were emulating it.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun. I was excited to read it, but I hadn't. It has been so long that I was a little worried. Only because I was like, oh no, don't disappoint me. Mm-hmm. You know, don't be better in my memory than in reality. But it was. It was very good.
I'm trying to think if there's a book that we have done for these where that happened. I think it was probably a little bit in the middle of. Or near the end of New Gods when we did it, where I was like, ugh. Actually, and that's true, that after the main story,
yes,
and there was the stuff that Kirby did later, and
the stuff that came back with wasn't as good.
Yeah, that's true.
But it didn't diminish the volume. It was just...
It's true. I mean, I think the thing, and maybe it's because we go into these wanting to like it and having good, fond memories, and so we give it, you know, but a lot of the book explodes that we've done... Even stuff that we'd never read before, when I think back to, you know, Born Again, which we'd read, but more or less not. Like, so many of them, there's just these, you and I, at least, are finding, this is great. This is everything that was great about this time. And I guess it's amazing how many of these actual great classic stories really hold up, not necessarily to modern comics, but they hold, the enjoyment of them holds up. Like, if you've been, awash in comic book history like we have for such a long time, then you go back to these roots things. It's like a Beatles album. You're like, oh, yeah, it's all totally there. It's great, you know. And that's really interesting. You know, you'd think, you know, you go back and you've seen a lot, you're jaded, you're whatever, you wouldn't be able to enjoy it. But, man, I feel like I enjoy these comics more than anything because it's not trying to be anything other than what it is.
Yeah, and you've got two people who are very good at making comics, or, you know, a whole team, but... Busiek and Pacheco and Stern and Marino and Olive and all of them. And Tom Brevoort was the editor, you know.
This is peak Tom Brevoort. This is what you hired Tom Brevoort for back then. and today to a certain extent, although he's the executive editor now, so he's less sort of hands-on, but I'm sure he knew all the stuff too.
And this is a meaty tome. You know, like, it's 200 and...
Yeah. Each of the issues 290? Was probably 22 pages, but they didn't feel like it. Like, I had to space these out. I was like, it was a lot.
Oh, yeah, no.
You know?
And I was like, oh, I'll sit down and read 5 of these. I'm like, nope.
Right. Like, on a given Wednesday any week, you know, we'll read 15, 20 books or something like that. And technically, this is only 12 issues, but you couldn't, like... Mm-mm. I couldn't imagine going through this in one sitting. It's exhausting.
No. I couldn't do it. I think I read 2 at a time. No. That was about as much as I could do.
Basically, yeah. Something like that. I did like 4 in my last, but it was over hours. Like,
well, also by the end, it's going downhill.
Yeah, no, that's actually true. It does pick up. At the end, you're not like, I just want this to end. At the end is when it all starts coming together in a really nice way, which makes that note you said earlier, but them kind of winging it, it makes it all the more impressive.
Yep. So let's do some ratings on Avengers Forever. The 1998-1999 12-issue miniseries from Kurt Busiek, Roger Stern, Carlos Pacheco, Jesus Marino, Steve Olaf, and Richard Starkings and Comic Albert Duchesne. What'd you say?
Duchesne. I mean, he could pronounce it differently.
Out of 5 stars, I'm going to give it a 4.8.
I was going to say 4.75. All right. There's nothing wrong with it. It is perfect to be what it is. It's not quite... you know, like all-time greatest things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just under there.
Yeah.
It perfectly represents a time.
Like you said earlier, I'd have a hard time finding faults, but it's a lot. And so that you knock off a couple of percentage, you know, not even full percentage points, just a little bit.
But I think a lot, the overload is its strength. That's what it's supposed to be. It's forever. It's, you know, all times. It's, you know.
Right.
But it is, that doesn't make it easy. How's that?
No. You got to work for it. So that was the Brooksplode for this month, although there's another one coming because we accidentally missed a month. So you can look for another Brooksplode, I think next week, actually, if you're listening to this live. We'll be talking about the death of Captain Marvel, another classic of Marvel story. This one, neither one of us had read before, as opposed to this Avengers book. So look forward to that coming out, as well as all of our podcasts. This is the end of the year, and we always cram a lot of shows in before our winter break. So you can find them all at fanboy.com, including our weekly Pick of the Week show, where Josh and I talk about the week's new comics. And thanks to the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy who unlocked this show for everyone to enjoy. And until next time, thanks for talking about the book with me, High Pockets.
Sure thing, Tall Socks. I wish I had time to think of like a snarky Clint-like chip on his shoulder, bedraggled response.
Right.
He's clearly just looking for acceptance and a friend. That's all he wants.
Yeah.
He just wants somebody to tell him good job. And the problem is he had a Captain America who couldn't even tell himself that.
It's true. They all had problems. It's the Marvel way.
Big time. Not Janet. She was with it.
She had no time for this nonsense. Look around. Grass is high. The fields are ripe. It's the springtime of my life. Stop and rebel for me at any convenient time.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.